In one of Saito Utejaniya's books, he says something like, "The meditating mind is simple, not complicated. The complicated mind, one that plans, has agendas, analyzes, is reacting, essentially. You know, the complicated mind, the one that is got a doing going in, is churning with doing, won't be able to see what's actually here because the doing is kind of in the way, in a way. So the simpler the mind can be, the simpler the awareness is, the more it can see. Now, what it can see is really complicated. The processes that go on in our bodies and minds are so intricate and entwined and complex. And a simple mind can see that. So something that's useful to kind of be aware of is, you know, the complexity of what's seen. Don't confuse that with the complexity of the mindfulness in a way. The mindfulness is not complicated or complex. If it feels like there's something complicated going on in our minds around the meditation, that's just something to know. Aware of complication. It's just an object. It's just an experience to know. Another piece about the simplicity, I mean, I've been talking a lot, right? I've been offering a lot of instructions and saying a lot of things about how we might work with this or that. And, you know, it sounds like a lot of things to do. And in some ways, you know, there are suggestions, especially if it gets really challenging. Now, there can be some things to do, you know, as we've talked about. If we can't just simply meet experience, if mindfulness is getting heisted, you know, is kidnapped by the rage or the anger or going into the rabbit hole of confusion, then it's not so useful to try to be mindful of that. And then it is time to bring in some tools, to take some action, to do something in our practice, to try to bring the mind back to some measure of balance, to be able to see what's here. But the basic instructions here are encouraging just a very simple, are you aware and what's obvious? A lot of what we're talking about in terms of the instructions is meeting different kinds of experiences or how, you know, how that might look, what we might see when we meet different kinds of experiences. And so, in a way, what a lot of the instructions are descriptions of things you might be able to notice, as opposed to things you should try to find. So think of it that way, in a way, you know, in terms of all of the information that I'm offering here. You know, I would sit with Saito Utejaniya and I would report, describe something in my experience, and he would comment on it and say something about it you know, say maybe you can see this or you might be able to notice that. And I would go off and try to find it, and I would come back and report. And he said, "Are you trying to do that?" And I said, "Yes, that's what I thought you told me to do." And he said, "Nothing I say is anything for you to do. It's just information that might help you to see what's happening in your experience." And so, you know, the instructions are, we can think of them as descriptions rather than instructions in a way. It's not so much something to do. What we do is really simple with the possible exception of those challenging times when sometimes a little more aiming and directing and settling, picking up some other tools can be really useful. So I want to get to some of the questions that have been submitted. There's a couple of questions on continuing this practice after the retreat, how to do that, what supports for that might be, and some questions on is it possible to integrate this practice with other practices? And what I, in reading and reflecting on this, I thought, I'm going to talk about this. I'll devote some time to this on Saturday, rather than bringing that in now. So just that we're really focusing on how to apply this practice and not bringing in other practices so much in terms of integration. It is possible, and I have done it, and I have a lot to offer on that, but I'll save that for Saturday. So if you can't get here on Saturday, it will be recorded. So that'll be there. So I'm going to save those questions. Let's say a question from a couple of days ago about making effort. I was talking about gently reminding ourselves, the frequency of reminding ourselves to be aware that that's a way of making effort, and that as we continue, as we get familiar with being aware, we may not need to remind ourselves as frequently. And so the question is, more clarification on that, please. At the beginning, perhaps we ask ourselves every 10 to 20 seconds, am I aware of what? Does there come a time when the frequency can extend to 10 to 20 minutes or 10 to 20 hours? Do we reach a point where we can just wait and see we are not aware and then ask? So I would say that the things I talked about the other day, the exploration of the prompting, the reminding ourselves to be aware, is one of the tools to support the awareness. And we can back off, and what I'd encourage is just backing off and seeing what happens as you back off. In my own experience, I almost never use that anymore. That conscious prompting, aware of what, it's just a part of the practice. And so I would say that it can get to the point where we just basically we notice we're aware again, and we don't even have to prompt at that point because we recognize I'm already aware. We don't even have to ask the question because the attunement to what it means to become aware is so familiar that as we become aware, we're just there and we don't need to make any reminders as we go. And so that can happen, but notice whether it's useful for you to use these prompts. When is it useful? When is it supportive? I think before the experience or the sense of what it feels like to be aware is more clear to us, these prompts can be very useful. The more we get familiar with the experience of the return of mindfulness and what that is, and the feeling of the momentum of mindfulness carrying. Basically, carrying the awareness, the momentum of awareness, carrying the experience that we don't have to try to do anything, like riding on that scooter. We're just there. The more familiar we are with that, the less we need to do the prompting. And also I'd say that the more familiar we are with that, it's just like we may begin to notice kind of a weakening of that momentum. And simply noticing the weakening of that momentum can be enough for mindfulness to become, have that momentum again. So it really becomes very quiet in there, over time, to not, we don't have to use those questions forever by any means, but just notice when they're useful. And then I also mentioned about several other ways, several other things that will support the continuity of mindfulness. It will support the momentum. And the big one there is curiosity. So rather than, asking yourself, am I aware of what? Just a curiosity of what is this? What's here? That can feel lighter and a little, it doesn't feel so rote somehow, like, You know, okay, am I aware? Am I aware? Am I aware? And so we're like, what's here? What is this? And so that the sense of curiosity can really help to carry the mindfulness too. So there's a lot of things that can support the continuity other than the that reminding ourselves to be aware. So this next question is connected to the description I had of my experience when I noticed, after having been looking, watching anger for a period of time, I noticed seeing in the mind the intention towards anger. You know, that I was cutting the apple and I saw a thought of my friend that I was angry with. That friend that, you know, the anger had been directed to arise in my mind, and saw the tendency or the inclination to jump on that thought and think more thoughts to get angry. And the question is, this story about noticing and short-circuiting the anger arising was inspiring. It seems important somehow to crystallize these kinds of moments of insight in order to treasure their power. Any comments on how to do this? So I'd say those kinds of moments, you know, those kinds of insights, often it's like that moment is just seared into my mind. It was such a powerful moment. And you know, I get to revisit it in teaching quite a bit, and I'm still actually seeing the subtleties and depth of what was seen in there. And so, yes, revisiting them can be powerful, you know, revisiting these in a reflective way. So I would encourage, you know, the reflective practice that I offered. This could be, you could use that reflective practice with insights. You know, just remembering, recalling an understanding or an experience in meditation, not to try to hold on to it, but just to see what's there in the experience as you recall that understanding or that insight. So I get to do this when I reimagine, you know, I describe the insight to you and I reimagine it. And it's like, oh yeah, there's that piece, you know. I noticed that, or you know, it wasn't actually something that I noticed in real time, but the understanding, you know, what was seen there was the non-arising of anger. You know, I don't think I really, you know, consciously recognized that until some time later. I saw the intention towards anger, and then that fell away. So, you know, seeing that somebody, you know, asked in the Buddha's teaching on some of the defilements. He said, you know, be aware of the non-arising of defilements. And somebody said, well, how do you do that? And I thought about my experience, and it's like, oh, this experience, this is one of them. This is a pointing to that. And so there's a deepening of the understanding, the wisdom that can happen through reflection on your own insights. I wouldn't do it in the moment that it happens. You know, actually just land with the feeling of what's happened. But you know, sometime later, you know, even a few weeks later, it can be useful, or a year or so later, it can be useful to revisit, especially these really powerful understandings that seem so deeply transformative. And it was clear to me in that moment that that moment was powerfully transformative. I sunk to my knees in the kitchen. It's like, oh my gosh, this stuff works. This is helpful. Wow. You know, it was so clear to me that this was a completely different way to navigate all of the things that had been whipping me around and making me non-functional. So, you know, it was very clear that it was a potent understanding. And yeah, you know, revisiting it can be useful. So I would suggest that reflective practice can be useful. And at times, conversations with Dharma friends. This can be a little delicate, you know, talking with Dharma friends about understanding and insight. It has to be someone with whom you feel very comfortable, with whom, if they start sharing their insights, you're not going to be comparing and, you know, judging yours and theirs. You know, it can be a little delicate, but it can also be really, really helpful to have Dharma friends that you have that kind of open sharing relationship with. So that's also a possibility to just share and try it. I think too, another piece that is useful about it is we have our insights, we have the understanding, and the insights are often, I would say the insights themselves are nonverbal. The understanding is nonverbal. Now, sometimes when we have an insight or an understanding, it in a few moments, very quickly can express itself in words. That's just the mind, kind of recognizing what's there. It's connected to perception and understanding, so it's sometimes the mind will articulate what has happened. Sometimes it's just a feeling, an insight comes and there's just an insight might just feel like a release. Is there something that's let go? And we have no idea what it was that let go. But we understand that something let go. That's about all that we know about what happened there, that there was a feeling of something letting go. So sometimes revisiting those moments can help there to be a kind of, and I'd say this is not, it's not necessary to do this. It's not necessary to know what let go in order for the letting go to be profoundly transformative. We actually don't have to consciously understand this insight or this understanding. I've seen that even more, as my more recently in my practice, the lack of articulation of understanding of what has been understood. It's just freedom, contraction. Freedom, contraction. It's like it's just really simple, but there's not much clarity around, like in that description with the anger, there's like this clear seeing of lockstep, of just like this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened and then this didn't happen. Just the seeing of that moment after moment was just so clear. And it was a gift in a way that it was so clear. It's not always that clear. And we don't have to go back and try to figure that out. But at times it might be interesting or useful to revisit something like that to see if there's some understanding that then might be able to be pulled into the conscious mind. One teacher talks about, I think it's Christopher Titmus. Talks about that we can be nourished by kind of pressing the honey out of our insights. And I would say this, what we're talking about is that kind of exploration, that there can be a little bit more of an understanding in our conscious mind of what happened. That might support us at another time. But don't get hooked to that as necessary, because I can tell you it is not necessary. So yeah, just those are a few thoughts on that topic. And then a couple of follow-ons from this morning. Talking about there was the question about elation and sadness and whether those are defilements or whether they can have a purity to them. And I talked about that this morning with respect to those two. And there was a question that just a comment in the chat. It sounds like the difference is the presence or absence of aversion and greed. And I would add delusion to that, the presence or absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. Whether those emotional qualities are defilement or not. And that's exactly what I understand. So that if sadness includes, if the feeling of loss and sadness includes an aversion, a wanting things to be otherwise, greed and aversion are present, that part will often be felt as a contraction. If that sense of wanting it to be otherwise falls away, there may be a sense of the purity of the understanding of loss, of perhaps just a sense of, yeah, that's gone. And there's a sadness there, but it doesn't feel like it's sticking anywhere. So we talked about that. And yes, I would say it is my understanding that the presence or absence of greed, aversion, and delusion is really what we're exploring with these emotions, elation, all of these things that maybe, we could say elation could be a near enemy to joy if it's got a little bit of excitement or a little bit of agitation. It's close. It's close, but it maybe has a little bit of, leaning into or not, tipping forward, not quite really here. So another question came up about this. Can anger be like the sadness you describe, pouring through and passing out in a more pure way? I'm afraid Buddhism misses some of the purity, naturalness, function of core emotions. So I would say with anger, I think anger is a really important thing to be aware of. I think sometimes the teachings are misunderstood to, so anger is, often understood, and I think is primarily, I don't know of any way in my own experience that anger has not actually had that aversion to it. It feels to me like anger has that unwholesome quality to it. And yet, I think the misunderstanding is that, we're supposed to not feel those, or, we're supposed to somehow, note them and they'll go away. And the teachings the Buddha offered is to understand it. So the exploration there is to understand the feeling, to not be driven by it, but to be really curious about it. So when anger is present, open to it fully. I talked about this with rage the other day, like let it get as big as it wants to, but be present with it. So the difference here is whether we are caught by the energy of anger and, driven by it, or whether it is present and we are able to be with it. So in that place where we're able to be with it, I would say there is that aversion in the system, but the way we're observing it does not have the aversion, does not have the greed. It can be a very pure knowing of the anger, a very pure knowing of the defilement. And in that case, the aversion, the greed is no longer shaping or controlling or conditioning. It doesn't have that conditioning power. It's kind of like we've taken, if it when we're hooked by anger, we are kind of, it's like we've got our gears on the gas pedal. We've got our foot on the gas pedal, and the gears are going. The gears are engaged, and the gas is going, and it's going. It's getting faster and faster. It's getting its own momentum. What becoming aware of anger is like is disengaging the gear. It's putting the car into neutral, not slamming on the brakes. You put the car into neutral, it's still got the momentum, but there's some capacity perhaps to steer the car and be aware so that you're not going to slam into things. And the momentum of the car will slow down because there's no longer that engagement. So that's very much how the mindfulness, that neutrality of the mindfulness works. It's like putting the mind into neutral, that the mind of observing is kind of that kind of action. So it can be felt in a way, you know, these core emotions that have reactivity, the practice can hold them with a purity in the mind. So we don't have to think, oh, because there's anger in the mind, you know, that's a problem. You know, the observation of it is hugely informative, as I learned in the first few months of my experience, you know, with looking at anger, how supportive that was to not try to stop it, but to also not engage with it. Now, one more piece I will say about this is that I would say often, you know, anger, and I think, you know, anger may feel justified when we see some kind of injustice happening in the world, right? When injustice is going on, how can we not feel angry? You know, there's the possibility of clearly discerning. So I think sometimes anger is mixed up with discerning injustice, with discerning this is suffering in the world, this is, you know, this is unskillfulness in the world, this is greed, aversion, and delusion at work in the world. You know, that anger can get mixed up with that, you know, that discernment. This is not helpful. This engagement is not supportive the way I am, or the way somebody else is, perhaps not supportive for peace and ease and harmony in our communities. And so to not, I mean, I think the opening to the anger in this way, where we see it and feel it, you know, get disengage the gears in this way, that creates the conditions where we can have a place of more clearly seeing the discernment of what's helpful and what's not helpful without being pulled into the reactivity. And so, you know, I think the exploration around anger is hugely important, and you may begin to see something different around discernment, that it's possible to clearly discern that's not helpful, that's creating suffering, and the response can be compassion rather than anger. Now, compassion comes with a wish to alleviate suffering, a wish to take action in the world. You know, so that place of discernment without anger. I mean, anger has kind of convinced us, I think, at times. Anger makes us believe that we would not do something unless we were angry. A lot of our emotions are like that. You know, why would I do anything if I didn't want to do it? You know, unless I had desire, unless I had greed, why would I do anything? Well, what happens is greed falls away as we start to see that our heart acts out of other wholesome movements, wholesome kinds of connection with intention. And so the you know, while anger believes I need to stop this thing or get rid of this thing, and that the anger is going to motivate that, and it does at times motivate that. But there's also the possibility of a heart that is not constricted, not angry, clearly seeing the conditions in the world, but experiencing a motivation to act to alleviate that suffering, to act to change conditions out of compassion and love rather than out of anger. So, that can take some exploration, and I really want to encourage the exploration around anger and what, I mean, don't just toss it out. You know, I think almost all, like all of our suffering, has some measure in there. You know, any constriction of our hearts and minds, any you know, anger, for instance, is a great one to think about, or you know, self-hatred for me was a big one. When I was first, you know, really touching into self-hatred, it felt so bad and just felt so, you know, wrong. You know, it's like it felt so icky. I just thought, well, this whole thing, you know, my job as a practitioner is to get the scalpel and get, you know, cut this out. You know, take this, like it's like a cancer in there. It's got to be removed. And you know, that approach of wanting to get rid of it, wanting to just obliterate it, basically is not honoring the fact that the feelings are kind of woven in with, tied up with, basically a sense of wanting to be safe, of happy, of peaceful, of healthy. A lot of it comes back to safety, wanting to be safe. A lot of our motivations around so many of this, the challenges we have, come back to wanting to be safe. Now, that wish in and of itself, the wish to be safe, that's metta. That's a wholesome wish. Now, it gets confused with the idea of there's some way to be safe. There's some like thing I need to do. You know, it's like if I don't do that thing, I won't be safe. So it gets messed up with all these beliefs and tangled up in knots. So we have this desire, these wishes for safety and well-being and happiness, these threads of metta in our, that's basic emotional content in our hearts, the wish for our own well-being. The Buddha said, we all have that. You won't search anywhere in the world for anybody who's more worthy of that than you. We're all worthy of that wish for happiness and well-being. And it's just a deep part of us. What it happens though is it gets tied up and confused with greed, aversion, and delusion. You know, it gets stuck with greed, aversion, and delusion. But it also gets stuck and tangled up with kind of the nature of the world. So we have the wish to be safe and happy and healthy. And then we've got the nature of the world as impermanent and unreliable and uncontrollable. Here we have the truth, what the Buddha pointed to, anicca, dukkha, anatta, and we have metta. And what happens when these two get in our minds? They mix up. It's like, it's wrong. It's either we believe that it's somehow the world is at fault for being impermanent and unreliable, or we're wrong for wanting to feel safe. And we're just fighting. We're fighting. These two are fighting together. And so we've got the truths of metta, the deep wishes of metta, and the truths of impermanent, unreliable, and uncontrollable. And our confusion about that, delusion, basically, that's where we get those knots. We get tangled up in a knot. And so this is our knot of anger. Here it is, our knot of anger. And inside that knot of anger, you know, what I've become to really appreciate is like opening to the experience here of any form of suffering begins to allow us to see those threads that are present inside the knot. The knot is the suffering. The threads that compose the knot are love and wisdom. And so the value of seeing, I mean, anytime we have any experience of suffering, there's the possibility that we can observe it and begin to understand not only the conditioned nature of that experience, seeing something about how it happened, but also something about the truths of the impermanent, unreliable, conditioned, uncontrollable nature of experience, and feel into those deep wishes for our own happiness and well-being, and for the well-being and happiness of others. And we begin to see that we don't have to take the scissors and cut that knot out of the cloth, which would just leave a hole in the cloth, but that the mindfulness can like lubricate this so that we begin to understand that these threads can coexist. And then we get this weave of love and wisdom instead of all tangled up. But this does take trust. This comes back to the thing I said, you know, at the beginning with the opening to the just the simplicity of practice, trusting that meeting these really challenging experiences is transformative. Right in the middle of these deeply painful experiences, insight, understanding can arise. Deep understanding can arise to help the mind see something completely new and different, transforming our experience.